Welcome to Creating a Family, Talk About Infertility. Today we'll be talking about understanding mosaic embryos and understanding we need to do. We get a lot of questions about mosaic embryos. There is so much misunderstanding out there. I think you're really going to enjoy this show. Here's a sample of what you're going to hear.
Mosaic embryos are embryos that have undergone pre-implantation genetic screening where the chromosomes of the embryo were assessed. And as opposed to that embryo being found to have only normal or only abnormal chromosomes, that embryo has been found to have a mix of cells where some of the cells contain the normal chromosome count and others contain the abnormal chromosome count.
This show is brought to you by Creating a Family. We are the National Infertility Education and Support Nonprofit. I'm Dawn Davenport. I'm your host and the director of Creating a Family. You can find us and all the resources we provide online at creatingafamily.org. The Creating a Family radio show is underwritten by our corporate sponsor, Ferring Pharmaceutical. Ferring wants you to know about a new tool that's available just for men. It's called FertiStrong, and it's an app. It's a self-help fertility support app specifically designed for men. Of course, it's for your phone or your computer, either one. But the app provides techniques to empower men with knowledge and self-help skills throughout the what we all know is a stressful journey of infertility. And I should add that it's equally applicable if it is the man himself who is infertile or if it is his partner. In both cases, they are members of an infertile couple, and it is important for him to get support as well. To learn more about FertiStrong, either for yourself or for the man in your life, you can go to their website, FertiStrong.com. In addition to our underwriters, we also have partners who believe in our mission of providing unbiased, medically accurate information and support to the patient community. And honestly, this show wouldn't exist without their support. One of our great partners is Cooper Genomics. They are a reproductive genetics testing laboratory focused on providing genetic tests and services for individuals and for couples who are trying to conceive. They were the pioneers of pre-implantation genetic testing, and they are proud to provide comprehensive genetic counseling to their patients. All right, today we're going to be talking about, all about, mosaic embryos. This is a topic that's, it's interesting. It's so often there's only topics that we hear about, those of us who are involved in this field. But mosaicism, or mosaic embryos, it's made the big times. There was a New York Times article about it early in the spring. There was a Wall Street Journal article about it, I believe, in March. And it even made People magazine, I guess we've hit the big times now, last month. So it's in the news, and we at Creating Family have a huge online support group, and we certainly hear people talking about it, asking questions about it. Hence the reason we're going to be talking today, what we know and what we don't know about mosaic embryos. Our guest experts are Dr. Alan Martinez. He is a board-certified reproductive endocrinologist at the Reproductive Science Center of New Jersey, and Erin Armenti. She is a board-certified genetic counselor at Cooper Genomics. She counsels patients on a lot of different things, including clinical implications of mosaic results. Welcome, both of you, to Creating a Family. And let me just jump in with a basic question that I think we need to start with, and that is, Erin, can you tell us what are mosaic embryos?
Yes. So mosaic embryos are embryos that have undergone pre-implantation genetic screening where the chromosomes of the embryo were assessed, and as opposed to that embryo being found to have only normal or only abnormal chromosomes, that embryo has been found to have a mix of cells where some of the cells contain the normal chromosome count and others contain the abnormal chromosome count.
Okay, so Dr. Martinez, what percentage of cells have to be abnormal for an embryo to be called mosaic? I mean, or is it common? Do all embryos have a few abnormal cells? Or is the presence of simply one cell enough to make an embryo be classified as mosaic?
So when These embryos are subjected to biopsy. This is usually done on day 5 or 6 of the embryo development stage. What is taken are about, you know, usually around like 5 to 10 cells per biopsy. And so you're sampling a portion of the embryo. So there can be various percentages that can result from that. The embryo can be completely euploid, or that's a normal chromosome complement, or it can have different percentages of the mosaic cells, which then, as we're going to discuss, guides us as to how we counsel the patients.
So how, Dr. Martinez, how does mosaicism occur? I mean, how does an embryo have both a complement of abnormal and normal? If the embryo is formed from all the same DNA, how is it possible to have different chromosomes depending on the different cells?
Mm-hmm. Well, when egg and sperm come together, there is a meeting up or crossing over of the genetic material. And through the process specifically of mitosis, without getting into the details, there are errors that happen. So things don't segregate or split apart properly, and you have some cells that end up with different numbers or different expressions, as was mentioned previously, that you'll have some cells that are normal and some cells that are abnormal. So it's a molecular kind of crossing over or mixture of between the egg and sperm that happens as the embryo is developing.
Okay, so Aaron, how common are mosaic embryos, or do we know?
So we're learning more and more about them every day. They're definitely more common than we originally thought, but we can see mosaic embryos representing around 20% of embryos tested.
Okay, so 20% of the embryos tested will show up as mosaic. Are they more common with embryos created through IVF than through those through natural conception?
So we don't necessarily have a mechanism of comparing the two, because we typically are seeing mosaicism at the time of embryo biopsy, which is only done with an IVF-created embryo. Mosaicism in pregnancy and in humans is also well documented in the literature, but at very different time frames, so it's not necessarily an apples-to-apples comparison.
Okay, well, that's so if I'm understanding you correctly, the only embryos that are being tested are those that are going through IVF, because obviously
Correct.
An embryo that is being conceived naturally is in the fallopian tubes at that stage, and so we're not
right.
going in and testing them. But we do test babies or fetuses,
mm-hmm.
through CVS or amniocentesis. So do we see mosaicism in at the time 16, 12 weeks, 15 weeks, 16 weeks, or whatever of for a fetus at that age? Do we see that, Erin?
Yes, we can see that. So there's a phenomenon called confined placental mosaicism, where that mosaicism is just that. It's confined to the placenta. So the placental cells have a mix of normal and abnormal cells, and the fetal cells are completely normal. So that's certainly well described in the in pregnancy literature. But then you also have individuals who can present for genetic evaluation for some cause or another, and they themselves can be found to be mosaic for various issues.
Okay, so adult humans will also do it through genetic testing. Dr. Martinez, if a person has a mosaic, has genetic cells, I mean has mosaic cells, I mean, can they still be perfectly healthy, or are they going to present with some type of issue, even if the issue is inability to conceive or some type of more obscure issue? Is it possible to have mosaic cells but still be, and I'm using air quotes here, perfectly normal?
Yes. So, I mean, this is the whole reason why the articles are coming out, is that patients have gone through these embryo testing, and with advancements in the laboratory, which Aaron can talk about, you know, even more so as far as the advanced screening techniques and the next-gen sequencing that is done, it has now allowed the laboratories to pick up these very detailed, so to speak, information about the embryos. But there are many of the embryos and a lot of the reports and literature that's out there that say when a patient has a group of embryos, and obviously you want to go for a genetically normal number of testing and embryos that exhibit that result as your primary embryo to try to transfer back into the uterus. But in some cases, as much of these articles allude to, some patients have a high level of mosaicism or a lot of embryos that don't have a normal chromosome complement per se, but yet they are able to conceive, carry, have a successful pregnancy and a live birth of to what, as far as we know, normal offspring, as far as developmentally, cognitively, and physically.
And have there been tests of the offspring? Because we're only now able, we'll come back, we're going to circle back to this in just a minute, but we're now able to know that there were embryos that tested mosaic and were transferred, and we now have babies that have been born. Have the babies been genetically tested? Are they genetically normal at birth, or have there been studies that have been testing that, Dr. Martinez?
Yes, that's a good point, and I think a lot of times what happens is when this genetic testing and this screening is performed on any embryos, when people are going through, as Aaron said, in vitro fertilization and embryo biopsy, it's still recommended that when that patient conceives, during their pregnancy, they go through the normal screening process for common genetic conditions. And so that is still recommended in standard of care. So that is done during the pregnancy, even before the child is born. And then when the child is born, as far as any further genetic testing, I think it's based upon the clinical assessment. If there is normal sort of development, motor, physical development, if the child or offspring look normal, then there's really no indication to further test the child, him or her, for any genetic conditions per se. So I think that, and Aaron, you can correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe that that's the way that people are being counseled. They get the testing during pregnancy to confirm the validity of these tests that we're talking about. And then when they ultimately deliver, it's left more of to the clinical and developmental status of that child.
Yes, more or less. We always talk about, you know, diagnostic testing during pregnancy being the gold standard. With mosaic embryos, we talk more about amniocentesis compared to CVS, and I'm sure we'll get to this down the road, but interestingly enough, when we talk about follow-up testing for an individual, you know, of course we want to think about an indication, but we always also need to think about what we're actually able to accurately assess. So if we're thinking of mosaicism as a mix of normal and abnormal cells in an embryo, we don't necessarily know what cell lines those cells will go on to create. And you're never going to be able to take a person or an embryo or a child and sample every single cell line. You're never going to say, you know, this child looks like he or she is slow in meeting his developmental milestones, so let's biopsy his brain to see if he's mosaic. So some of these samples we're just never going to be able to fully ascertain. But yes, Dr. Martinez is correct, as most of the confirmatory testing is done in the prenatal period.
I want to come back to the cell lines, but let me first ask a question that we got from one of our audience. She says, we have one embryo frozen and had it tested. It is mosaic. Our doctor will transfer if we want to and if we see a genetic counselor, which we will do before we decide. I would like for you to ask your guest at what point in the pregnancy we could know for certain if the embryo converts to normal. We are thinking that it might make sense to transfer, and if it sticks, to do CVS or amniocentesis, and then we would have more information on whether to terminate the pregnancy. I think, Erin Armenti, that's what you were talking about. So let's talk to her question. All right, if she transfers and the mosaic embryo, and if it implants and if it grows, will she have enough information? And you've already mentioned that you prefer CVM, amniocentesis, which is done at, what, about the 16 weeks versus CVS, which is done, what, 10, 12 weeks, something like that?
Yes. So we talk about amniocentesis specifically with mosaic embryos because the CVS, which is done earlier in pregnancy, is a biopsy of the placenta. And when PGS testing is done, the cells that are biopsied from the embryo are from the part of the embryo called the trophectoderm, which grows into the supporting structures of the pregnancy, things like the sac and the placenta. So we already know that the cells that are going to go on to make up the placenta have this mosaic finding. With an amniocentesis, it's a sampling of amniotic fluid where there are fetal skin cells and cells from the GU tract primarily. So it's a better assessment of what directly is going on with the fetus. So that's the reason for the recommendation around amniocentesis, though again, always with the caveat that we're still not sampling every cell line, but the amnio can give you a better sense of what might be going on with the baby.
So she would have more information at that stage. Now she'd be much further along in a pregnancy, obviously, but she would have more information whether or not the amniotic fluid is showing cells that continue to be abnormal. Is that enough information to know, be able to say whether the fetus is abnormal, though? And let me ask that question back to you, Erin.
Yeah, that's a really tough question, and my patients ask me that all the time. And basically what I tell them is, you know, a normal test result is a great thing. That's absolutely what we want to see. What we always have to keep in mind is the limitation of the testing that we can do. You know, I have a lot of patients who tell me all the time, I want the test that looks for everything. Give me that test, and my answer is always, gosh, I wish I had one for you, but that just doesn't exist right now, and there's not a test that is going to be able to rule out every problem with a pregnancy, whether it's chromosomal or genetic or otherwise. But I would say a normal amniocentesis result is certainly what we would want to see in that situation, but unfortunately not a guarantee that nothing could go wrong.
But what if the amniocentesis shows a continued, so some normal and some abnormal, is that possible?
That is certainly possible as well, and that would be a stronger indication that there was potentially a chromosome problem with the fetus.
Okay. All right.
And of course, do you mind if I comment on
a little bit
on that?
No, please.
So, yes, so from the clinical point of view, you know, when our patients are pregnant, so they will generally undergo this, you know, sequential screening and they'll also do a detailed ultrasound that will allow potentially to look for any clinical sort of biomarkers, any sort of clinical evidence on the ultrasound visually if there's anything going on with the fetus. And so that kind of is taken with the information that Erin's talking about as far as the actual amniocentesis test result to kind of counsel the patients. And I agree exactly what she's saying is that no test is perfect. So we counsel our patients that all this technology exists, all of these tests, but it's not a black or white. It's not a 1-to-1 ratio. If you get this result, you're absolutely going to be in this case scenario. So we have to take all of the evidence, laboratory, clinical evidence, you know, how's the pregnancy going, the growth, all of these specific details, and then formulate our counseling based upon that.
Yeah, I think we all want to believe that these tests are black and white, and of course sometimes they are, but so often they're not, and we certainly see from the patient community, you know, they're begging for just give me answers so that I can make decisions. But so often the answers, as you were just saying, you've got to piece together all the evidence and then make your best judgment based on that, because it's not a yes or no answer sometimes, which is so frustrating.
Correct.
Yeah. All right, I wanted to come back to, and I'm going to direct this question to you, Dr. Martinez. I wanted to come back to cell lines. So when you are doing an embryonic genetic testing, PGS, pre-implantation genetic screening, when you are doing that, you mentioned before that you usually do it at around day 5. and that you're pulling off about 5 to 10 cells. At that point, how many cells is an embryo?
It's around 200, give or take.
Okay, so you're getting a fairly small percentage of the cells, 5 to 6 out of about, I mean, around 10, say, out of about 200. And you're pulling these from what part of the embryo?
Yeah, so Aaron had exactly alluded to this before, and but it was there's a lot of details with all of this. So you're pulling from the there's two parts of an appropriately growing or developing embryo. It's called a blastocyst, and it has an outer layer of cells, which is almost a single layer that kind of lines the outside of the circular portion of the embryo, and that's called the trophectoderm, and that ultimately becomes the placenta. And then you have what's called the inner cell mass, which is what ultimately develops into the embryo. And as she has mentioned, the cells are taken, you know, just from the point of view of easier access is from the trophectoderm, the outside of the embryo itself. But you're only taking a certain handful of cells. You're taking them in a certain portion of the embryo. And you're not doing multiple biopsies in different areas because that would just be way an excessive amount of trauma potentially to that embryo. So these cells are taken from the outside, and that's why it's not a absolute representation of the entire embryo. But it is the latest, the greatest thing that we have in our sequencing of these embryos, next-gen sequencing biopsy, that allows us to assess the kind of the quality of these embryos.
Okay. So we're really taking from what we think is going to be end up forming the placenta and the support structure for the fetus. But the expectation is if that's abnormal, that's a good indication that the inner circle of cells that will become the fetus itself are also abnormal. Am I understanding you correctly, Dr. Martinez?
Correct. And so there's different categories. You either have a euploid, which is a normal chromosome complement, which is what we prefer, aneuploid, which is an abnormal representation of the chromosome number, which is clearly an abnormal embryo, and currently it's not recommended to transfer that embryo. And then you have what we're talking about is a mosaic, which is these intermediate embryos that exhibit a different two different populations of cells that in some cases and can end up with a clinical pregnancy and a live birth. So, you know, the goal from a clinical and provider point of view is to carry forth these IVF cycles in a way where you hope to get a euploid embryo. If you do not, then that's where the mosaic conversation kind of comes into play, and that's where Erin and her counseling becomes so, so important. Because as a question earlier said, at the end of the day, you would rather have euploid embryos. If you go through one cycle, if you go through three cycles, if you go through over 10 cycles, like some of these patients that are in the mainstream articles out of the New York magazines, then it's all you get is mosaic embryos, then that's where oftentimes mm-hmm. providers say, okay, well, now this is where we clinically say, okay, do we consider transferring those embryos as your chance of getting pregnant?
I mean, I'm glad you raised that that point. I think most people would agree that if they have embryos that have tested normal, euploid embryos, that's the ones that are going to be chosen because it's more likely, of course, that they're going to implant and grow. This really comes up most often when the patient doesn't have any normal embryos. And then because there's a cost, there's an emotional cost, but there's also a financial cost. And if they've gone through a number of cycles and still have had none normal, then they have to make decisions on whether or not they want to try for a genetic child, assuming that they're using their egg and sperm, or if they have to move to a different form of family, creating their family. All right. Coming back, one of the things that strikes me is that we're hearing a lot about mosaic embryos now, but we haven't heard a lot about them in the past. So, Erin, why is that? I think Dr. Martinez has already alluded to the answer, which is some, you know, the advances we see in genetic screening. But can you kind of walk us through how genetic screening has evolved and why now we are seeing, are hearing more about mosaic embryos than we have in the past?
Yes, absolutely. And as Dr. Martinez said, it mostly has to do with improvement in the technology. So the way PGS testing was done even 4 or 5 years ago was via a technology called ArrayCGH, and it was very good at counting the chromosomes, but it was not as subtle of a technology as what we have now, which is next-generation sequencing, or NGS. And what NGS really allows us to do is visualize more of this gray area that mosaicism represents, where we're looking at a cluster of cells that don't have a completely normal chromosome complement, but don't have a completely abnormal chromosome complement either. So it's really the function of a more sensitive technology. And mosaic embryos have been around as long as embryos have been around. It's just now that we're actually able to see and identify them.
Do we have any idea what percentage of normal pregnancies? I guess we wouldn't, because I guess we could look at CVS results. Do we have any idea, Erin, what percentage of normal pregnancies result in this?
Not really, and I think that's
normal conception.
Yeah, not really, and I think that's one of the things that makes this dialogue so difficult, is because there's not that frame of reference with kind of a non-IVF pregnancy.
What about CVS results, Dr. Martinez? CVS has been around for a very long time. I'm not saying, and I suspect that you would see fewer, but I guess I don't really know that, mosaic results. It seems like the further along in a pregnancy, you would see less mosaic results, because the pregnancies that have that start from mosaic embryos would be more likely to miscarry. But do we know what percentage of CVS, people who have done CVS, have results that would show mosaic, or has that technology not been around long enough to determine that either?
Well, yeah, and it's basically almost the same answer as what Erin had talked about, which is, you know, the laboratory assessment and technology has only allowed us to test this over the last few years, really.
Gotcha.
And
even for CVS.
And now, yes, correct. So we don't have good numbers with this, and we know that, as Erin had said earlier, if it's around 20%, some studies say a little less, some studies say a little bit more. I think that 20% is very valid, you know, a very valid number. Then you can allude to certain situations, you know, and say, okay, we may be in the range of this percentage, but again, it's only an educated guess, you know, and. There's plenty of embryos that have been transferred over the years that are probably mosaics that we had no idea about. And whether they ended up in pregnancies or not, we'll never know, because we didn't test those embryos. But now the technology is here, it's being talked about, and we have to now continue to work within this field. And that's what the company that Erin works for, I mean, they're doing an amazing job of you know, doing studies on this, you know, as the technology advances, looking at the data to kind of tease these answers out that the patients have, and the patients want a statistic. We always don't have it, the perfect statistic for them, and a statistic is only that. If, you know, I always say, tell the patients, if you have a 5% chance of getting pregnant at the end of the day, if you get pregnant, for you, that's 100%, you know. So it's only a guidance, and we don't have all the perfect numbers for whether it's CVS, amnios, or, you know, the embryo biopsy like we're talking about. So as we begin to study this more, I think some of that will come to light. But right now we're kind of in the infancy of this whole arena.
That's such a good point, and it's, pardon the pun, in, as far as infancy, but you're exactly right. This is, we really, I hear a lot of frustration from the patient community, but we all have to understand that as the testing has improved, it does throw us into an area of unknown. But that's to be expected, in the sense that you can't know everything until you've, and you know, the tests have just come around that we've been able to be this refined to find it. So unfortunately, we're kind of at that point where the tests are getting better, but our understanding and our research hasn't yet caught up because it hasn't been around long enough for us to have done all the research. Although, as you point out, there's been a number of studies that have been published this year in various journals, including Fertility and Sterility. Aaron, are different labs having defined mosaic embryos differently? If you go to one lab, you're going to stand just as good a chance of having a mosaic result as another one. Do all labs have the ability to enough refined technology in order to find mosaicism?
That is a very complex question.
I keep sending the complex questions to you, Erin. Do you notice that?
That's okay. You're keeping me on my toes. I like it.
And she's doing great. She's doing great.
Thanks, Dr. Martinez. The short answer is yes. The technology is widely available to allow for the detection of mosaicism. As far as the subtleties between labs, every lab has a different product that they use. Every lab has different protocols for how they report those. So that being said, if you sent, you know, the same biopsy to two different testing labs, you may get concurrent results or you may not, just based on the sensitivity of the specific platform that the laboratory is using and what their reporting parameters are. So for patients, that is, you know, a great question to ask is, you know, when do you report mosaicism and then what levels can you see? Because, you know, even with the very, very refined technology that we have now, not every level of mosaicism is detectable with current technologies.
And this may be old information, but certainly as of last year, I know some labs don't report mosaicism at all. As I understood it, it was because they felt that there was pressure to report from the clinics. Clinics wanting, don't give me any wishy-washy results. I want to know whether it's normal or abnormal. Is this currently, Erin, from your standpoint, is this something that you currently see, or is that was that last year's news?
I think we're moving further and further away from that. I think a lot of the initial backlash around mosaic reporting came in that original transition from array CGH, where an embryo was very clearly either euploid, chromosomally normal, or aneuploid, chromosomally abnormal. And then when the transition was made to NGS and this third category, mosaicism, got thrown in there, I think a lot of physicians and a lot of patients were initially apprehensive because, like we've been talking about, there wasn't a ton of outcome data, there wasn't a ton of research, and there weren't great guidelines as far as what do we do with these embryos.
Exactly.
Now, as we're getting more and more information, and honestly, you know, our patient population does tremendous work in educating themselves, and they learn a lot about this too. The people are still frustrated by the ambiguity, but by and large, they want to have as much information as possible in making decisions about what to transfer.
Yeah, there has been some surveys done on just that, and you're right. The majority of patients say they want the information. Dr. Martinez, from the doctor community, although I think that we all wish for less ambiguity, is there greater acceptance now, or do you still see or hear that some clinics are saying, you know, we only want you to report normal or abnormal. You make the decision in the lab. How is that handled from the clinic level from what you're seeing now?
I think that more providers than not in the infertility world are now, you know, using that as and taking advantage of the information and counseling our patients appropriately. I have, you know, it's a relatively small field, reproductive endocrinology, infertility. So, we have a lot of colleagues, throughout the country and the world that we're talking about this and, forums, and we go to the society meetings. And I think definitely there's just more often than not, the technology and the information is now being welcomed. It does make our counseling a little bit more difficult because of this new gray area, and it's something that each practice, we had to sit down amongst us and say, hey, how do we feel about this? What does the data look like? How are we going to counsel our patients? And I believe just as, there's many different ways to get to the same outcome, and it's about how you counsel the patients and your approach as and your confidence in the laboratory you use, and just letting the patients know that, hey, nothing is 100%, but this is the current thoughts in the field, and this is kind of what our recommendation is. And so we sit down with the patients, and I think more often than not, the physicians are now utilizing the information and holding on to these mosaic embryos for sure. If they're being transferred, if they're not being transferred, obviously a euploid embryo is still preferred, but in the cases of one cycle, two cycles, three cycles, et cetera, and you only have mosaic embryos or patient, these IVF cycles are so tricky. Like you alluded to this earlier, it's stressful for the patients. There's three aspects. There's financially, which is a huge thing. There's emotionally, and there's physically, and they take a toll. So you have to kind of gauge where your patient is. What are their resources? Do they have another cycle in them? Have you exhausted your measures to try to get a euploid embryo? Counsel them, provide the data, and then let them make an educated decision. But like Aaron said, they do an amazing job of kind of getting ahead of that education curve early on, and so they're able to handle this information. And I think that in the end, where the technology a few years ago was either euploid or aneuploid, there was nothing in the middle. For many patients, this may have created a situation where some embryos were discarded that could have potentially, gave them a clinical pregnancy and a birth. So we do have a long ways to go, but the technology is exciting, and we just have to navigate and get some good data behind all of this so we can best counsel the patients.
What, Aaron, what percentage of the time, and I think there has been some research on this, of course, everything we're going to say now is there's been some research, but how much, because the testing has only been around this refined for a couple of years, so it's not a long-term type of research. But from what we're seeing now, what percentage of the time will a mosaic embryo produce a chromosomally normal baby?
So what we're seeing, and again, a lot of outcome data still rolling in, but what we see is around a third of the time when a mosaic embryo is transferred, we see a healthy ongoing pregnancy.
Okay, and then Dr. Martinez, if the embryo is not does not grow into a healthy chromosomally normal baby, what are the most likely, we've got implantation, can fail to implant, it can miscarry or have a stillbirth, or there can be a birth defect. Do we know percentages on those options? So from a patient standpoint, if an embryo that tests mosaic is transferred, what are their odds of, we said about a third of the time they'll have a healthy baby. What percentage will it be a fail to implant? What percentage would be a miscarriage or stillbirth? And then what percentage would be a birth defect?
So that is a loaded question there.
I'm just in pain now. I've been directing most of the loaded questions to Aaron accidentally.
Yeah, no. No, it's fair. So,
yeah.
Okay, so you have to keep in mind that the patients undergo clinically and biochemically, they do blood tests, depending upon their medical history. So looking at, okay, is it an issue with an embryo? Is it a chromosomal issue? Or is the function of that embryo separately from the chromosome? Say the chromosomes are perfect. Even in a perfect embryo, you still have pregnancy rates that probably are still 30 to 40% negative pregnancy rate or biochemical pregnancy, which is an early positive level. That even in normal chromosome embryos, they don't end up with clinical pregnancies that result in live birth. So there's the genetic aspect, but then there is the uterus itself. Patients undergo a series of tests to kind of delve into that and to answer that question before they usually get to the IVF process. So that is, in most cases, the major structural conditions of the uterus that would affect pregnancy, that's addressed beforehand. But we don't know about the actual working of that embryo separate from the genetics. So you can have a normal chromosome embryo, but yet it can still result in a negative pregnancy. So to then take a mosaic embryo and then to come up with birth defects, we don't have that data. You know, like, from my understanding, correct me if I'm wrong, Aaron, but I believe that the literature so far, they haven't found any birth defects in any of the live births that have resulted from this. Is that correct?
That is correct. What has been reported is what's consistent in the general population, which is that 3
yes.
to 5% risk.
Yes, yes. So there appears to be no increased risk, you know, based upon the data that we have of the live births that resulted from the mosaic embryos. And so we obviously can't delve into and figure out, okay, what's the percentage of stillbirth? Because clinically, if the pregnancies are going well and the baby's growing appropriately, stillbirth can be related to so many other causes, pregnancy-related conditions, separate from either the working of the embryo, the health of the fetus, that can lead to these things. So, but overall, of the patients and of the embryos and the transfers that have resulted in a clinical pregnancy and a live birth, the data preliminarily looks very reassuring in these cases.
And that's good to know. So, Aaron, do we understand the mechanism by which a mosaic embryo turns into a normal embryo? The term that you see bandied about, and this is probably not a medical term, but it's what the common press reports, and that is self-correct. Do we know how a mosaic embryo can get rid of the abnormal, or do they not get rid of it? Do they just push it into the placenta? But even an abnormal, you know, we think of chromosomally abnormal cells in the placenta would keep the placenta from functioning the way it should. So I guess let me go back to the question. How can a mosaic embryo self-correct? Do we understand that mechanism?
There's a couple hypotheses for the different mechanisms there, one being a little bit of what you just alluded to. You know, when we in a very good explanation for why mosaic embryos can make healthy babies, which is that the mosaicism, that mix of normal and abnormal cells, is really located exclusively in the placenta. And the inner cell mass, the part that goes on to make up the fetus, was and will always be completely chromosomally normal. Other thoughts are that, you know, those cells can get pushed into the placenta, or that the abnormal cells may die off at a higher rate. I think as we learn more and more about this, there probably won't be one identified mechanism behind this, but rather several.
Yeah, and the question I always had was referred to before. If the abnormal cells are just found in the placental tissue, but wouldn't that impact the functioning of the tissue of the placenta? And if that's the case, wouldn't we see, you know, more preterm births or smaller babies? And we're not seeing that, right? I mean, as far as I research that I've seen, we're not seeing that.
Correct.
Right, and I think it also depends on what that percentage of abnormal cells is. And then, you know, further, and I talk to patients about this too, oftentimes, you know, even if some of those abnormal cells are in the fetus, depending on what cell lines they occupy, it may not be a problem. You know, and an extra chromosome in your fingernail cells may not be such a big deal, whereas if instead that you know, extra chromosome is in your brain cells, that's where it could be very problematic. So I think there are a lot of different explanations out there.
Explain, Erin, what you mean by the cell lines. Would you see different cell lines in your fingernail than what you would see in your brain?
Right. So that goes back to, you know, one of the possible outcomes with a mosaic embryo. We've talked a lot about inner cell mass being normal and then the trophectoderm being mosaic. One of the other possibilities is, in theory, that the inner cell mass is mosaic as well, has that same mix of normal and abnormal cells. And one of the reasons why that's so tricky is because when we're looking at an embryo, we don't know which cells are going to grow, which cells are going to grow into what cell types. So if that chromosome abnormality is confined to a cell line, like a hair cell or a fingernail cell, that, you know, isn't something that's particularly active in the growth and development of a person, that may never be a problem. Whereas if instead, you know, that chromosome abnormality is in a more critical tissue like heart cells or blood cells, that's where we can expect to potentially see problems. But again, what this kind of circles back to is you're never going to be able to test every cell type in a person. So it again gets back to the general ambiguity surrounding this.
And when, Erin, when adult humans are tested genetically, mm-hmm. again, we're not testing all cell lines either, mm-hmm. but how often is mosaicism, how often do you find genetically abnormal cells and cell lines of adult humans who are asymptomatic, without symptoms?
You generally wouldn't expect to see that because those people typically aren't undergoing genetic testing. And that's the tricky thing about mosaicism when we're looking at children or adults who have been tested for this, is that there is an ascertainment bias there. You know, you're never going to go to your doctor for your annual physical and say, I feel great, everything looks good, you know, I don't have any problems, I don't need any medication. Your doctor's never going to be like, well, we should rule out mosaicism and you just in case. you're going to be tested for that if you're presenting with some issues. So there's definitely an ascertainment bias there.
That's a good point. Yeah, and good luck getting your insurance to cover it if you try that.
Exactly.
Yeah. Well, and just from an ethics standpoint, too, you don't just genetically test people for the heck of it. Dr. Martinez, we know that chromosomal abnormalities are more common with older mothers. Is mosaicism more common with older moms?
The current thought is that mosaicism is not necessarily related, it correlates with a maternal age. So, again, the technology has only been out, you know, for a certain number of years now, but it does not appear to be as important as general aneuploidy rates, such as things like Down syndrome, that increase and the miscarriage rate increases dramatically with, you know, increases in maternal age. So mosaicism has not exhibited that general trend.
Interesting. And if a pregnancy results from a transfer of a mosaic embryo, is that pregnancy considered a high-risk pregnancy, Dr. Martinez?
Currently, no. No.
Okay.
And I can expand upon that because...
Yeah, please.
In the vast majority of cases, when you have a clinical pregnancy and it progresses and it's going well, and your early numbers are going up, you know, after the positive pregnancy test, your beta HCG level is climbing nicely, do clinical ultrasounds, and you know you have an intrauterine pregnancy and the growth is normal, then it goes into standard surveillance throughout the pregnancy. So then you would look more at, okay, what is still the overall age of that patient? Are they at risk? You know, you're still going to counsel them accordingly with their other medical problems, but the pregnancy per se from a mosaic embryo is going to be treated no differently than a euploid embryo or a natural pregnancy.
Okay. It's interesting. Then this may be, Erin, this may be a difficult question because I realize that each case is individual, but Walk us through how you would, what factors you would try to help a patient see and assess if they have a mosaic embryo or a couple,
mm-hmm.
and let's assume that they don't have chromosomally normal embryos, so that the person you're talking with is having to make the decision of whether or not to transfer these embryos. Can you help walk us through some of the things you would talk with that patient about and help them understand so we can get a feel for the complexity of the counseling that would have to take place?
Yeah, so there are a couple different things that I specifically talk about with every patient when they're considering transferring a mosaic embryo. We spend a little bit of time talking about, you know, the difference between the trophectoderm and the inner cell mass, as we've been talking about a lot today. And we talk about the different possibilities of outcomes for mosaic embryos. And those include, you know, no implantation, a pregnancy that miscarries, a perfectly healthy child, or a child that's born with problems as a result of the mosaic, as a result of mosaicism in the inner cell mass, which we haven't seen a lot of in outcome data, but we can't rule out from a theoretical basis. And we talk about, you know, the numbers that we see behind these different outcomes, and we talk a little bit about what brought that patient to IVF and PGS to begin with, because one of the things we haven't talked about a lot today, but is also, you know, well defined in the literature, is mosaic embryos implant less and miscarry more compared to completely normal embryos. So a patient who's coming to IVF and PGS after a history of recurrent pregnancy loss where she's had three or more miscarriages may feel very differently about that compared to a patient who's never, you know, gotten to the point where she's had an embryo to transfer or had a clinical pregnancy. So, you know, we talk a little bit about those outcomes, and we talk a little bit about what seems like the right fit for the patient. You know, I have some patients who say, look, I feel like I understand this information, and I feel like I know there's maybe different recommendations for follow-up during a pregnancy, but I'd rather transfer this mosaic embryo and see what happens than consider another cycle of IVF or consider switching to an egg donor or something like that. I'd like to transfer this embryo. And then I have other patients who say, look, I feel like if I transfer this embryo, I'm going to be a nervous wreck from the moment I have a positive pregnancy test until my child goes to college, and I just don't want to set myself up for that. So we spend a lot of time talking about the information, and we spend a lot of time, you know, talking about the patient's perspective and how that might color their decision. And as Dr. Martinez alluded to earlier, you know, what if this doesn't work, what is their plan B? You know, is it hopping right into another cycle of IVF, or is it considering something like egg donor, embryo donation, adoption, et cetera? Because that all tends to color how the patient feels about the potential transfer of a mosaic embryo.
You know, that's such a good point. And then they also have to think through what, you know, their age, I mean, and their finances.
Mm-hmm.
Can they afford another IVF cycle? Or depending on their age, does it make sense to go through another full cycle? What are their ovary reserves, egg reserves? You know, all of that information
mm-hmm.
has to be factored in as well.
Yes.
Yeah. And Dr. Martinez, yes. From your standpoint, because you're also counseling patients, are you seeing a greater understanding, a greater willingness now to transfer, or still a great deal of hesitancy?
I think that we're still seeing hesitancy overall.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah.
But like Aaron said, you know, you sit down with your patient, you know the testing, you know that they've gone through, you know how many cycles, what's the egg yield, what's the quality of the embryos, how many embryos were tested, what's the proportion of normal, abnormal embryos, you know their medical history, you know, have they, like she said, have they been through no pregnancies in the past, have they been through 4 miscarriages, have they had something, been misdiagnosed and had complications from a DNC that would be done for a potential miscarriage. You take
mm-hmm.
all of those factors, you talk to your patient, you have an honest conversation with them, and oftentimes, you know, their history in what you're able to obtain from a given IVF cycle or cycles will often make that decision for you. And I think that, you know, overall, we know the way that it seems to be coming into play clinically is that we will counsel the patients, we will go through IVF cycle. Usually if it's the first IVF cycle and you don't get normal euploid embryos, but you get mosaicism numbers, a lot of times the patients will elect to go through at least one more IVF cycle, okay? And then after going through a couple of cycles, and depends upon the patient, you know, history and their care up to date, then when people have had a chance at something a couple times, that's when some of the realities of what their body is going to give us, what quality of the embryos, what odds are we against, that's where people will then oftentimes say, you know what, I'm either going to take that chance or I don't feel comfortable with that, let's move on to our other options. And I mean, Erin answered it beautifully, and I think that she, the way that she's counseling them, I could just tell, is very supportive, educating the patient and considering everything as a whole, because it's not just the embryo, whether the embryo is normal or abnormal or mosaic in between. It's rather what has the patient gone through. You're trying to help somebody build a family, but you don't want to destroy the patient, that couple. You know, it's physically, financially, emotionally stressful. And mm-hmm. to have that at the forefront in your counseling, that's where the patients are really going to get the best care. And I completely agree with that approach.
Dr. Martinez, a year or so ago, we certainly heard of clinics who were discouraging or not allowing mosaic embryos to be frozen. Is that still the practice, or is it more common now to go ahead and allow the embryo to be frozen to give the patient that option in the future if they were to choose it?
Well, I think based upon the literature out there that the patient is best served by holding on to those embryos. And, you know, the evidence is showing us that live births can result. It can result in what are considered to be, you know, normal development, normal children. And therefore, I think that, you know, most of the colleagues and the meetings that we go to, you know, I would say that more of the doctors are on the fence of keeping the embryos. There's always going to be outliers, you know, and there's always going to be people that for any number of reasons may be hesitant to do that. But I feel that in our practice in particular has said, hey, at this point, if we're not going to use those embryos, we're going to hold on to them. It may not be the first avenue, the treatment that we would recommend, but you have to consider the possibilities and consider your patient. And I think discarding those embryos at this point is honestly not the preferred option.
You know, last year at the American Society of Reproductive Medicine, ASRM, annual meeting, there was I attended some presentations, and there was a great deal of discussion with some doctors feeling that patients should not be given the choice, that the doctor themselves felt like that it was wrong to transfer a mosaic embryo. I'm assuming that the year has since passed, and I'm assuming that as more information comes in, we will be reassessing. But why would a doctor feel like that it is simply wrong to even allow the transfer of a mosaic embryo? And I'll ask that to you, Dr. Martinez.
Yes, I think that it's very difficult to, you know, to delve to the bottom of what's the driving mechanism for that, for the particular physician who may counsel the patient that way. I think that they may see it as more black and white. In the past, it's always been a normal embryo or abnormal. And so they may be hesitant, for whatever reason, to kind of skate that middle ground, so to speak. And but you know, that's why you have to follow the literature. That's why you have to discuss with colleagues. You have to go to these meetings, stay up with all the latest, you know, technology and discussions. And ultimately, you as a provider make your own decision. But it's not black and white. These do result in normal pregnancies, so it's hard to argue against the using the technology and counseling patients and educating them when you have these situations where you have you know, live births and apparently healthy children, you know. And so that's that. Really, at the end of it, you know, that's an individual decision, and I think over time, more and more doctors are going to recognize the literature. We're going to get more research, get concrete numbers about these pregnancies, about these embryos, because the numbers are going to drive up. Even with this conversation that we're having, all these articles, people are already doing this at a much more frequent rate than 1 or 2 years ago. I mean, tremendously.
Yeah.
So we're gonna be able to figure out a lot of these questions in your difficult data estimates that the patients always want to know about. So I think that, you know, it's an individual decision, and just you have to stay up on the literature and just make your own educated decisions. But I think the patients have the right to at least know the information that's out there, and then that's patient autonomy and guiding them, saying this is what we know, and letting them make their decisions and feel comfortable with that.
And one of the things that we say so often is you need, when choosing a lab, you absolutely need to find one that is going to provide good genetic counseling, because seldom is this issue black or white, and you need someone. You should not be, the patients should not be alone in trying to figure this out. And a good genetic counselor is just essential for really any time you're going through any form of genetic testing, but in particular, at least with our audience, it's the embryonic testing. So it's crucial. And what we tell people is that you're not going to be alone. If you choose the right lab and you choose the right clinic, you're not going to be alone in making this decision. You're going to have some information. It may not be black or white. But you'll have information. We have time for one last question. It's a long one, so I am going to paraphrase. She is 6 months pregnant with an embryo that had tested, just one, and tested Mosaic. She is trying to decide if she needs to or she should report this information to her pediatrician. Does she need to be on the lookout? Should she make certain that her child knows it so that they can report to subsequent doctors as the child grows? Erin Armenti, what would you counsel her? It seems to me there's some advantages and disadvantages. Kind of comes down to how much information do we want to share with the outside world? But in this case, her specific question is the pediatrician.
Yeah, it's a great question. And again, I think it comes back to this not necessarily being a one-size-fits-all solution. I think, you know, if the question is, hey, do I want to confirm, you know, that there isn't, you know, any underlying issue, do I want to rule out any sort of mosaicism, then that's maybe something to consider talking about with the pediatrician. But as Dr. Martinez talked about earlier too, you know, the benefit when you're dealing with a baby or a child is that you also have the ability to correlate clinical symptoms. So, you know, not something that can also be considered down the road as well. And as far as, you know, the implications for that child when he or she is ready to have their own children, I've not heard that question before. It's a really great one, and I'm sure I'll hear it another, you know, 6 times before the end of the week now. but again, I think it's largely, you know, a personal preference about that type of information.
I think we're all going to be facing that kind of that general question more and more as time goes on. As I think clearly medicine is moving towards the genetics, and there, I think that's a really good general question for all of us to be thinking about in the future, as to how much information and who do we want to share it with, and with our children, can it be used to hurt them? On the other hand, we certainly want to share as much information as needed to give our doctors. So it's not an easy question, so thank you. Thank you both today for talking with us about a both fascinating and evolving the topic of mosaic embryos. Let me pause for a moment and say that this show and all the resources we provide is supported by and would not happen without the support of our partners. And these are organizations that believe in us and believe in unbiased education to the patient community. One such organization is Fairfax Cryobank. They have been a leader in sperm donation for over 25 years and are dedicated to supplying updated, verified, and accurate medical and personal information on their donors. As we often say, keep in mind that the information given in this interview is general advice. To understand how it applies to you and your specific situation, you need to work with your infertility professional. I realize that everybody now has more questions, and to get more information from either of our guests, Dr. Alan Martinez, you can go to his website, which is fertilitynj.com, to get more information about Aaron Armenti and Cooper Genomics. You can go to their website, which is coopergenomics.com. Thank you for joining us today, and I will see you next week.